The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Friday morning California time space show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in, and we have a new guest with us today, and one who's been requested many, many times over for many listeners, so I'm happy to introduce Dr. Jay Malosh in just a minute. But first, the usual business of the day. If you would like to call and talk with our guest today, it is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. And do remember, there are no call screeners, so be patient. And if you get put on hold, just wait and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And we do answer the phone during the break, but you may get put on hold. So again, just be patient. You can also use email if you're listening at work, for example, and can't make the phone call. And email is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then you can post comments or ask questions on our blog, which is to go to our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right for upcoming show menu. And we're the first show listed, so scroll all the way down, and you'll see comments. And you do not have to log into our program Discuss to do it. You can do it as a guest. And as soon as you post your question or your comment, I will get it, and I can bring it up on the air for our guest today. But again, we do prefer phone calls if you can do it. 1-866-687-7223. And also, if you happen to be on our website, thespaceshow.com, we do have a detailed website newsletter. And do check it out. It tells you all of the details of programming for the week. But we're also rapidly filling in all of the Space Show dates between now and the end of the year. So you'll see the programming we have coming up. Everything we do is archived. As you know, you can download shows very quickly or listen right off of our website. If you're interested in Space Show t-shirts and things of that nature, it's in the upper left menu under support. And then there is also an upper left menu item called Listen Live, and you're welcome to share this with people. It tells you how to listen to live programs, how to listen to archives on the website, which are compressed MP3, and then how to listen to various podcast forms that we have, including Alexa, which is, of course, by Amazon. The most important is supporting the Space Show, because we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we're listener-supported, which means we're able to bring you these programs because you support us, and we deeply appreciate your financial support. Remember, if you're paying U.S. federal taxes, you do get a tax deduction. The same if you're paying California taxes. Our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Do check it out. If you have nonprofit 501c3 contribution donation questions, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And in addition to that individual support, we also have sponsors for the Space Show. Each of our sponsors gets a banner ad running across our homepage, and they can change that banner ad from time to time. Do check them out because they do change their underlying message. For the first segment, our sponsors include Northrop Grumman, a leading global security company with innovative systems, products, and solutions for both government and commercial worldwide. And their technologies range from undersea to outer space and cyberspace. The Space Foundation is a sponsor, and they're also, by the way, a 501c3. And they have their annual space report on their homepage. You should check it out. And this is kind of an economic financial report card on the global space industry, both public government as well as private, from around the world, and they do this every year. So if you want to see how well commercial space or new space or space in general or telecommunications are doing, this is where you go, and that report is really amazing. So I strongly, strongly recommend it. And then also the Space Development Network is a sponsor. This is about supporting space settlement. And if you want to join in these efforts, go to their website, spacedevelopment.org, and sign up. It's free. And again, you can play a role in helping to advance space development. And then also for this segment, the National Space Society is a sponsor. So in addition to their famous ISDC event, which is about 1,200 or 1,500 people, which they have every Memorial Day, around the Memorial Day time, they do other things. They have white papers, study reports, and events, like they have a space settlement conference coming up in Los Angeles in November. And I know space settlement is important to many Space Show listeners. So we deeply appreciate our sponsors. We could not be doing the Space Show without them. And again, check out their banner ads from time to time. And if you have a way to support our sponsors, please do. And then one other thing you'll see on our homepage, a giant Amazon button in the center. And that's because Amazon has truly great nonprofit supportive programs. And there are two of them, and One Giant Leap is registered. So if you click on that big Amazon link, it'll take you to our One Giant Leap Amazon page and explain both programs. And if you do shopping at Amazon, from specialty items to just routine stuff that you buy around the house, Amazon donates a portion of your purchase price to your nonprofit, which would be One Giant Leap. And many of you do that. We appreciate that support. And we thank Amazon for having these truly great nonprofit programs for just buying most normal things you would buy on Amazon. That brings me to our guest today, and over the year, many listeners have suggested I invite Dr. Jay Maloche of Purdue University to be a guest on the Space Show, so I did do that, and he graciously accepted. He is a distinguished professor of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Science at Purdue, and he also has appointments in departments of physics and astronomy, aeronautical and aerospace engineering at Purdue. He has research areas involving impact cratering, planetary tectonics, the physics of earthquakes, landslides, and much, much more. His full bio from his website is on our website, so do check it out. And he really is an authority and an expert on asteroids, especially those that might come a little close to Earth, for example, and other different things that we talk about all the time on the Space Show. So, Dr. Maloche, it's really a pleasure to talk to you, and I understand that another area of your specialty is a new term for us, geologic violence. So welcome to the program, and what do you mean by geologic violence?
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be part of your program. When people ask me, what do I do? And I look for something that's linking the things that you read off already, impacts, earthquakes, landslides, really geological violence kind of summarizes all of that. Not something I ever intended to get into, but I actually kind of got into studying impacts from doing plate tectonics many years ago, but it seemed to be an area, a big growth area in science, and I've followed that up ever since.
So is this specifically related to Earth or any place in the solar system?
Well, any place in the solar system, the impact threat on Earth is something people think about. We've seen too many disaster movies not to be aware of it. But if you look at the face of the Moon or Mars or Mercury, they're all scarred by, you know, big circular structures that we now know were caused by meteorite impacts. Most of them very, very long ago in the past. But it's clear that this kind of one body running into another, you know, geological violence of high-speed impacts has been part of every planetary system history, including, we think, probably exoplanets as well.
Why do we not see them? And I guess fortunately on Earth that often. Has something happened to make it happen more seldom on Earth than it maybe used to a long, long time ago?
Well, impacts are actually pretty rare. When we think about the age of most bodies in the solar system, the moon, for example, 4 billion years old, and it's had time to accumulate lots of craters. We don't think that the Earth has been immune from that, but on Earth, unlike the moon, we have rainfall, we have geologic processes. The wind blows things around, and that tends to erase craters. You know, mountain building will erase craters, plate tectonics, and so on. And so the Earth is not immune from impacts, but we have other processes that act on the surface that tend to erase them. We know of the existence right now of about 180 craters on the Earth of different sizes, whereas if we look at the moon and start counting, you know, we kind of run out of fingers really quickly. The numbers are in the millions.
And so what is the role of plate tectonics in our atmosphere in minimizing these impacts? Do they destroy the objects before coming in? Is that the role, or is it something else?
Well, it's not really. The atmosphere is a pretty good screen against small meteors. Things that, you know, maybe 50, 60 feet across, seldom make it through the atmosphere. They may deliver a couple of rocks that people value as meteorites, but, they limit the amount of damage that occurs to the surface of our planet. But as you get up to bigger sizes, you know, rocks that are 100 to 200 feet or more in diameter, those make it through the atmosphere and create craters on the surface. So we're not immune to that. And, you know, if we look at the moon, we don't even see the small craters that would get screened by the Earth's atmosphere. So we're as vulnerable to big impacts as any other planet.
So is it fair then to say that they don't happen as often as they did a billion years ago? Or I mean, why is the moon so, you know, cluttered up with craters? Is it still happening at the same pace, for example, and the same with Mars? Or what has slowed it down?
Well, we think that what you ask is a really good question, and I don't really have a full answer to it. That's something that's still being debated quite a bit in the scientific community. We certainly know that shortly after the planets were formed, the impact cratering rate was much higher than it is now. And it has slowed down probably in the first billion years of planetary history down to a lower level. There may have been spikes. We think that during the Ordovician era, about 400 million years ago, there were was a higher flux of meteorites on the Earth. The only fossil meteors that we know of come from quarries in Sweden, for example, and only in a certain age interval, where at a time we think that there was actually a big impact in the asteroid belt that created what's called the Flora family now. But aside from that, we have to assume that the cratering rate has been more or less constant, but that's only given that we don't have very good evidence for it. What would be really great to do is go back to the moon, collect rocks from 10,000 craters and date them all, but that's something that's pretty far in the future. It is clear, though, that in the early solar system, there was a lot higher impact rate. Now, you may be referring to something called the late heavy bombardment. There's been an idea in the literature, you know, since the 1970s, since some of the lunar rocks came back, that there may have been an era about 700 million years after the initiation of the solar system when there was a period of very high impact rate on the moon. That era of heavy bombardment has been challenged recently, and there's currently a big debate going on in the scientific community about whether or not that was in fact real.
How does it get challenged, and how does it get resolved?
Well, it gets challenged mainly by normal science. In fact, in this case, it was a actually a young researcher at UCLA who started measuring the dates of meteorites and that came from the moon by potassium argon, which indicated to many people that there was a period, again, about, you know, 500 to 700 million years after the formation of the solar system, that that indicated that there'd been a lot of bombardment at that time. What he found is that through gradual diffusive loss of the argon, that it gave only an indication, and he argued that it would be only an apparent age, that all the ages clustered about that time, and that even if there had not been a spike in heavy bombardment, we would have that appearance in the current record. That was really the capstone just a couple of years ago of some other suspicions based on studies of lunar meteorites, that the late heavy bombardment, if it existed, was actually a lot more gradual or extended over a much longer era than had been suspected before. This is all kind of the normal science of, you know, people making hypothesis. In fact, the idea of the late heavy bombardment was a hypothesis. And then, it being checked up by newer techniques, better instrumentation, being challenged. This is the way normal science is done.
Does it ever get resolved one way or another, or does it remain as a competing theory or a challenge?
Well, we'd like to think so. You know, over time, ideas get, you know, accepted, and if there is enough confirming evidence, they, you know, become more or less set in stone, but there is almost no idea in science that's not open to challenge. And if, you know, new information accumulates that indicates even a long-held hypothesis is not right, well, we have to take that seriously.
Your first email question from today is from Bill in St. Louis, and he says, I have a two-part question for you. The first part is, what is the minimum size of an incoming rock that would be considered a planet killer, like the one that killed all the asteroids? And number two, we often hear that we need to go to Mars so that humanity can survive, since someday in the future Earth is going to be hit by one of these big incoming rocks. Would it be easier to figure out how to defend Earth, or is it easier to start a new wing of human civilization on Mars?
Wow, that's quite a question. I think the first part, in terms of the asteroid killer, I think he may mean, you know, a life killer. I'm guessing, sort of along the line of the fact that the dinosaurs, we believe, were wiped out 66 million years ago by, an impact of a moderate sized asteroid. And, you know, the dinosaurs certainly didn't have a space program. They were completely open to or vulnerable to rocks hitting the Earth. The minimum size required to cause an extinction of that level, we suspect, is probably a diameter, if you don't mind if I use kilometers, because I'm used to thinking that way,
okay,
about 10 to 12 kilometers in diameter.
10 to 12 that hits the atmosphere or the surface of the Earth?
Anything that big that hits the atmosphere will hit the surface. The atmosphere is completely ineffective as a screen at that size. You know, the average height, so-called scale height, over which the atmosphere loses about a third of its density is only 8 kilometers itself. And so this is something bigger than the concentration of the atmosphere toward the surface. So, the front of it would be hitting the surface at the same time the back is in almost complete vacuum. So, yeah, the atmosphere wouldn't play any role there. Something that big is probably enough to cause a global extinction. Fortunately, such impacts are pretty rare. You know, the only three that we know of in Earth history were the ones that killed the dinosaurs 66 million years ago, and then there are two others of comparable size that we know of that are back almost 2 billion years ago, one in South Africa and one in Canada. There might have been others. There were other extinctions, like the one at between the Permian and Triassic era, but although a lot of searching has been made for evidence of an impact at that time, nothing has yet been found, although it seems now to have been a rather sudden extinction that kind of suggests something like asteroids, but most of the scientific community now attributes that to a major volcanic eruption that was going on in Siberia at the time.
So what would be a better approach to figure out how to defend Earth or to get a sampling of human civilization off to Mars?
Well, it's really hard to say. Well, first of all, we can assure listeners that there's nothing targeted on the Earth of that size now. Concern that a big asteroid impact might do us in has affected a lot of people in the past, and there are asteroid searches that have gone on now for 30 years, and we've identified, we think, right now 95-96% of all objects that are 1 kilometer across or more that cross the Earth's orbit. And at the moment, there are about 1,200 that cross the Earth's orbit, but none of them as big as the asteroid Kilmer. A 1 kilometer asteroid will make a crater, 10 to 15 kilometers across. There are many of those that we know of on the Earth, and none of them is associated with an extinction. That said, though, there's been a lot of concern about impacts just of that size and larger, because although it might not extinguish all life on Earth, it would make us mighty uncomfortable. It's believed that an impact of that size would cause global crop failures for a couple of years. It would change the climate briefly enough to do that. Now, we don't have, as a civilization, an awful lot of food stored. And if you think of it, if we had crop failures for a couple of years, perhaps 90% of the human race would starve to death. That would be very undesirable. As a result, the searches are being pushed now to even smaller sizes to make sure that at least we know about anything that's targeted on us. Right now, there isn't anything.
That we know of.
That we know of. There is possibility of that couple percent that we don't know about that we've missed. There's also the possibility of a comet that comes in from outside the solar system and is targeted on us. Although actually the likelihood of impacts is much, much higher for asteroids than comets. An asteroid that crosses the Earth's orbit does so about twice a year, a time and again, and as a result, the chances are eventually it will hit the Earth. But space is big, asteroids and the Earth on the scale of the solar system are small, and so such impacts occur maybe every few million years. But it's not something that you need to worry about happening tomorrow or even over your lifetime. But the question, is it better to defend or is it better to leave the Earth and go elsewhere? The Earth is a pretty nice place. We get free oxygen. We get protection from cosmic rays from our atmosphere and smaller meteors. Mars doesn't offer any of that. We'd have to create that. You can't go out on the surface of Mars and walk around. There's no air. There's not much atmosphere. And as a result, there's radiation that, cosmic radiation that, would fry you over, a few years. Any future Mars colonists are going to have to live underground and go out, only at rare times, maybe only at night when they can't see the sun.
Is there anything that Earth does or that happens with Earth or by Earth that attracts these big rocks, or is it truly just an act of randomness in nature?
Well, we do have a gravitational field, and a rock that gets close to Earth gets deflected toward the Earth, and that increases the impact probability a little bit. We use the term gravitational cross-section to indicate that for an object, especially one that's approaching the Earth slowly, our gravitational field is effective at bending the path and making it more probable that it hits the Earth. But that's, you know, maybe a factor of two for most objects. It's not a major player in the probability. The main thing is that in something that's crossing our orbit is that it gets the chance to approach us again and again and again.
So, It's truly random then, and you know, there's not much we can do about it unless we develop some kind of technique to change its course.
That's correct. Right now, well, we know the orbits of most of the things that are crossing, big objects that are crossing the Earth's orbit. And there's been a lot of discussion about the technology to deflect asteroids and, you know, what's the best way to do that. Unlike the dinosaurs, we do have a technology that could deflect asteroids. Of course, the biggest ones are the hardest to deflect, but they're also the least likely to hit us. In addition, the other factor in whether or not we can deflect something is time. That is, if we know about something long ahead of time, we're able to do something about it more easily than if it is something that's imminently coming down our throats, like a comet. So, that said, there are different proposals for what you could do to deflect the asteroids. I'm sure, you know, everybody who's watched movies about asteroid impacts, is aware that there's a lot of discussion about using nuclear weapons. People say, oh, well, we'll nuke it. We'll send a bomb out there and blow at the smithereens. Well, you know, those smithereens, you know, there are more of them than there were of the original asteroid, yet they carry the same energy. And is it better to you know, have the same energy fall into Earth's atmosphere over a broad region, or would it be better to have all the energy in a narrow region? That's something we actually don't know. Nobody's yet done that study. Some of those rocks will be radioactive. I'm a player in some of this discussion. I'm very concerned that we might use nuclear weapons, but my concern isn't so much about multiple rocks versus one rock or radioactive versus not. I mean, there are arguments by different people that might or might not be a big problem. My main concern is that if we develop nuclear weapons with a kind of a launch-on-threat capability, which has been discussed, we're much more likely to use them on Earth than we are against the asteroid. The initial thoughts on the so-called standoff scenario would require nuclear weapons with an energy yield far larger than anything that's ever been used or created. Tested on the Earth. The biggest bomb that's ever been set off was a Soviet bomb, 58 megatons. The original estimates is you might need 1,000 megaton yield weapons in order to deflect, say, a kilometer-sized asteroid. Well, there's no theoretical reason. The weapons designers tell us that they couldn't make a bomb that big. Of course, they'd want to test it before they, you know, deployed it against an asteroid. And, you know, how comfortable would you feel with a bunch of orbiting 1 gigaton bombs supposedly to use against asteroids? But, you know, how likely is it that they might get used by some madman on the Earth? I think that's the big threat.
I've done shows with people from Lawrence Livermore Lab on their Project Hammer, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And they're using it to try to deflect and move the the approaching orbit of the asteroid, not blow it into smithereens.
That's as I was saying, that's the standoff scenario. There are other ways of deflecting asteroids. One is the so-called kinetic impact, which just involves running a massive spacecraft into something well ahead of time, and that may give it enough impulse to deflect it. Of course, a big asteroid is harder to deflect than a small one that way, but that is, for medium-sized asteroids, a very effective method. Another method that actually I pioneered with a Russian colleague, a guy named Ivan Nemchimov, he and I a few years ago conspired. Well, he was in the Soviet nuclear weapons program and actually had personal experience of almost being killed by a Soviet test that went wrong. He was terrified of the possibility of the use of nuclear weapons and proliferation of nuclear weapons. So we conspired in his kitchen in Moscow, what better place for a conspiracy, to try to find some method that we would deflect asteroids that did not use nuclear weapons. And what we cooked up was something that we call the solar deflection scenario, an idea that we published in the magazine Nature a few years ago, in which the idea was to simply take a big passive solar collector, you know, huge disk of mylar, aluminized mylar, focus light from the sun, so it's all very very ecological, focus sunlight onto the surface of the asteroid, which would vaporize some of the asteroid, and the continued expansion of the vapor from the asteroid would push it off after a year or two operation and deflect it from the Earth. And we can show, at least on paper, that it's as effective as nuclear weapons. Now, the technology for that is not much developed. Certainly the nuclear weapon technology is further along, but that method has the advantage that these solar collectors are fragile, they're big, they're hard to hide, and as a result they would make very, very poor weapons, but they would be very effective at deflecting asteroids. There's also the gravity tractor that the B612 Foundation has been promoting as a way of deflecting asteroids. I mean, we have the technology to do these things without necessarily using nuclear weapons, it might be better for us, I think, to develop or focus on the technology that doesn't itself pose a threat to us.
Carolyn in Seattle has a question for you, and she says, in trying to look at these big asteroids that are coming in, maybe they're very rare on Earth, but are you seeing them occur less rare, say, on Mars or other planets in the solar system? Do they happen elsewhere more frequently, or are they rare no matter where in the solar system you look?
Well, we think the cratering rate on Mars is pretty comparable to that on the Earth and the Moon. After all, Mars is closer to the asteroid belt than we are. The impact velocity on the surface of Mars is a little lower than on Earth, but in fact, the cratering rate is quite comparable, and so we can use, actually we use it on the inverse. We use the cratering chronology of the Moon, which has been calibrated by a few samples from the Apollo missions, and then apply that to Mars with a factor, which is not very big, a little less than 2, for multiplying the Moon cratering rate for the Mars cratering rate. And then we use that to estimate the ages of surfaces on Mars based on the number of craters that we can count per unit area. In terms of the amount of cratering on Mars versus Earth versus the craters on Venus, say, or Mercury, we think they're pretty comparable throughout the inner solar system.
You mentioned when we were starting the show geologic violence. So if we look at Mars or the other parts of the solar system or places that seem to have a human spaceflight interest, where, you know, there might be a chance for some form of life or something, Titan, you know, maybe Europa or something. What about the other forms of geologic violence? Do they, are they still hit by, for lack of a better word, earthquakes or Titan quakes or whatever we would call them? What other kinds of violence hits these solar system bodies, or maybe even exoplanets, if we know enough about them to be able to determine that?
Yeah, well, certainly impacts, as we know, are one big hazard to anything on the surface. Both hazard and advantage. I mean, impacts also bring in, you know, biological molecules. There's much speculation that amino acids may have gotten seeded onto Earth from comets back when life was starting four and a half billion years ago or so. But in terms of other things, are there earthquakes on Titan? Well, we think that there are faults there. There are certainly structures that resemble faults, although the resolution we have isn't great. And if there are faults in a brittle crust, we expect that there would be earthquakes. We do definitely see faults at higher resolution on some of the other bodies in the outer solar system, on Europa, for example. There may indeed be earthquakes. We don't actually know. We don't even know if there are earthquakes on Mars. We have had a seismometer, or three of them, operating on the moon for a short time after the Apollo missions. We know there are moonquakes, and there's some peculiar aspects of moonquakes even. They're typically not as big, or at least none were recorded as big on Earth. Are there earthquakes on Mars? Well, we certainly hope so, because we have right now a NASA mission is headed to Mars called InSight with a seismometer on board. And the hope is to detect earthquake waves and use those to probe the interior of Mars, use those as a scientific tool to learn more about Mars. But we don't know if there's any signal there, and the hope is, since we do see lots of faults there, that definitely we'll see something. On the other hand, the Earth's tectonics are much more active. We have plate tectonics going on here that have changed the face of our planet, you know, over and over again. On a period of 100 million years, if you kept coming back to the Earth every 100 million years and took a series of photographs, you'd see what looked like a different planet every time, because the plates are moving around that fast. Typically, you know, 10 centimeters a year, so about as fast as your fingernails can grow, is the rate at which plates move around. But if you grow your fingernails over, you know, say 100 million years, you'd find them to, you know, be the width of the Atlantic Ocean. You know, we have this kind of activity going on, probably because we're such a big planet, and our planet has difficulty shedding its heat. Mars doesn't have any such thing going on. Now, Europa, that has very few craters on the surface. It looks like it gets resurfaced. Europa may be comparable to the Earth. It's not exactly terrestrial plate tectonics that's going on, you know, something else. We know that, or at least have evidence that there is new crust forming on Europa. We don't see anything like subduction zones where crust on Earth disappears. That's something that we'll be investigating when the upcoming Europa missions get more detail there. Venus also, as a big planet, has been resurfaced. Its surface age appears to be something like 500 million years. It may be, for some reason, not quite as active tectonically as the Earth is, but it's very volcanically active. And we believe it was almost completely resurfaced by a planet-wide spasm of lava flows back about 500 million years ago. But, you know, smaller planets, Mercury, Mars, the Moon, their surfaces haven't changed very much, we think, in the last 3 billion years or so. And they're certainly not as internally active as the Earth is. Our big surprise is Pluto. which was supposed to be small, inactive, and by golly, we see it has, you know, there are mountains on Pluto that make it look like Switzerland. They don't have craters on them. They have what look like glacial features. There are vast plains that seem to be churning over, you know, with not a single crater that we can resolve, look pretty young geologically. Well, Pluto's an ice ball, and even though it's small, it may have some antifreeze like ammonia inside that keep the interior churning around. Pluto turned out to be really interesting.
Are there lessons to learn from Pluto? Did it really shake up science to think something that far out would be so different than what was expected?
It certainly did. We expected to see a cratered ice ball that geologically died 4 billion years ago, and instead we find an active world. It's a little bit like Titan. I mean, Titan is another object that was expected to be basically geologically dead, and yet the landscape of Titan looks very, very Earth-like. It's got lakes, it's got integrated drainage systems, of course with methane, not liquid water. It's a lot colder than the Earth, just like Pluto is. Pluto is still colder. But the lesson we've learned recently by this exploration is that the icy objects in the outer solar system are by no means as uninteresting as was expected.
So I guess it's not even sensible or practical to think that there could be like one granddaddy solar system planetary exploration mission that could study all of these things with one finite cost over X number of years, that everything has to be so specialized to this or that specific body. Could there ever be one sort of catch-all, really effective granddaddy mission for massive learning?
Well, I don't think anybody who really thought about it would even advocate that. And the reason is that as we learn, you know, new things, our ideas about what to look for and what's important keep changing. So this incremental acquiring of knowledge is actually helpful, so we can decide what to do next. If we put together the the granddaddy do-it-all mission and sent it out, what we'd probably find out is that we actually sent out the wrong instruments and that there were things that were unexpected. You know, the Viking missions to Mars in the 1970s were a little bit like that. The two spacecraft were supposed to be life detection spacecraft that would do it all, that had a number of instruments that would, in the thinking of the day, definitely establish whether there was life on Mars or not. They were entirely successful missions from the engineering point of view. They landed successfully on the surface. The experiments were worked, and we still argue about what the conflicting results from the experiments actually mean. Some of the experiments were consistent with life being in the soils; others weren't. The thinking now is that what was observed was active chemistry in the soils, but we're not sure. And there's still talk about, well, you know, what kind of experiments would we send to Mars to look for life? NASA's being a little bit more cautious now in not advertising, for example, the Curiosity rover as a life detection mission. It might find it, but that's not the plan. The Mars 2020 mission, which is much more focused on life, is also focused on caching samples that would be brought back to Earth that we'd be able to examine in terrestrial laboratories. And what you do there is you make an initial analysis or first cut at what's in the sample, and then depending upon the results, you may do different kinds of tests. That's hard to do with a do-it-all mission. And so even if we had infinite amounts of money and were able to mount something like that, I don't think anybody who really thought about it and understood the way science and exploration happens would advocate for such a thing.
You mentioned Earth return samples. Are you worried about them coming back on Earth? Do they need to go to a space station lab or any kind of off-Earth lab in terms of planetary illness concerns, protection concerns, or just...
Or planetary quarantine.
Yeah.
I actually think that we need to protect Mars better than protecting the Earth. There are folks I know who worry about samples coming back from Mars and advocate for that. In fact, some of the work that my students and I have done have been focused on that possibility. The Phobos Grunt mission that the Russians mounted a couple of years ago was of some concern that way. Of course, it was moved because the mission failed. But, you know, we will have samples brought back, and I'm sure that there'll be a lot of concerns about contamination. But the fact is, we have Mars samples on the Earth now. Those are Martian meteorites. And given the rate at which we find Martian meteorites, you can estimate that about 1 ton of Martian surface rock falls into our atmosphere every year. And that's been happening for the last 4 billion years. Do I worry about contamination from Mars? No, because it's already here. If it were dangerous, we would have been contaminated long ago. In fact, you might argue, and I have done that at times, that in some ways Mars is a more likely place for life to have gotten started in the early solar system than the Earth, and it might be that life originally came to Earth from Mars, that we analyze the conditions of the launch of Martian meteorites, their transfer through space, their entry into Earth's atmosphere, something I've done with a colleague, a biological colleague named Wayne Nicholson. We've done evaluations, experiments on the launch phase, the cruise through space, the re-entry, and, you know, throughout a series of papers we published. And it seems overwhelmingly likely that if there were life on Mars that were ejected in a meteorite, it could come in a viable form to the Earth. And perhaps much more rare Earth ejecta could go to Mars, carrying viable microorganisms. We think of right now, actually, that Earth and Mars is not biologically isolated places, but we exchange material all the time. It could be that if life really started on Mars, we, in fact, are all Martians. And we just migrated from Mars to Earth. That's a testable hypothesis, as wild and crazy as it sounds, because if we were able, if we did find some kind of life on Mars, we could, you know, figure out how it worked. If we found that it used something like our DNA with the same genetic code and some similarities to Earth, we would have to conclude that life on Earth and Mars are related. So that's one exciting possibility, that if we do find evidence of life on Mars, we have to look pretty carefully at the possibility that it's related to Earth.
Does that mean animal life like lions, elephants, dogs would be related to Mars too?
Well, what I'm talking about of exchange of organisms, I mean microorganisms,
okay,
bacteria and so on. You know, larger life would not survive launch. The meteorites that come from Mars were launched from the surface by bigger meteorite impacts, and upon launch, they go from being resting on the surface to 5 kilometers a second in a couple of milliseconds. So the accelerations are hundreds of thousands of G's. Anything like a giraffe an insect or smaller multicellular organism would get squashed upon that kind of ejection. But microorganisms survive that fine. And we know, because we actually did experiments where we launched microorganisms in the Ames vertical gun from a block of granite that we inoculated with our own genetically labeled bacteria. We impacted the block at 6 kilometers a second, collected the ejecta, and by golly, there were viable bacteria with our genetic label stitched into their genome that we were able to recover. So organisms can take that, microorganisms, but not larger animals.
So I have a call waiting for you and an email. I'm going to take our call. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Doug from Southern California.
Okay.
I had a question sort of on the small end of things, very small, micrometeorites and sort of smaller meteorites, and their risk to a lunar base. Is there much of a risk? I mean, I've done my own back-of-the-envelope calculations using data from the Echo 1 and Echo 2. These were like inflatable sort of reflectors in the early years of launching satellites. These are very large. I mean, like, I don't know, 30 meters across. And I think they were up in orbit for 5 to 8 years without being punctured by micrometeorites. So is the risk of puncture to an inflatable habitat while when it's having telerobots push dirt on top, how big is that risk, in your opinion?
There is such a risk. Not only from the primary impacts, which take place, typically about 11 to 17 kilometers per second. That's way faster than a rifle bullet, which, I mean, rifle bullets seldom exceed 1 kilometer per second. And so there are these, small objects traveling around at speeds, 10 times or more than a rifle bullet speed on the surface of the moon. In addition, there's a significant hazard by more distant impacts of larger objects making secondary debris. Now, on Earth, an impact like that, the small secondary fragments would be slowed down by the atmosphere pretty quickly. But on the moon, there's nothing to stop it. And so the secondary debris traveling a bit slower, maybe a kilometer per second, rifle bullet size, muzzle velocity, would still be pretty hazardous. So I think that would be and is a significant hazard to such moon bases. You don't want to spend an awful lot of time outside in a spacesuit. The other risk from lunar shelters, especially inflatable ones, is cosmic radiation, which you need typically about 40 to 50 feet of lunar dirt to stop. So you don't really, those pictures of pretty domes that you see on the surface are really pretty unrealistic from the point of view of shielding you from the radiation hazard.
Our secondary, not secondary radiation, but secondary meteorites, do those really happen from micrometeorites?
Well, they do happen from micrometeorites, but of course the secondaries are smaller than the primaries. There's a kind of, small melt particles in the lunar regolith have been found called agglutinates that look like they were the result of micrometeorite impacts. How big a hazard those are, I think that's something that needs to be evaluated. That probably a relatively thin bit of shielding, thin being millimeters, might be enough to deal with that. But the micrometeorites themselves are a hazard that have to be carefully countered.
Yeah, I mean, by my rough calculations, I estimate it take about 3 days to put just a minimal layer, actually be a few centimeters thick, over the habitat. So do you have any quantitative sense of the risk?
There have been quantitative estimates made, and right now I don't remember them well enough to speak on the phone to that. Certainly there's literature of people that have made estimates of those risks.
Okay.
They're probably not showstoppers, but it's also something that needs to be taken into consideration.
Yeah, I think it's just prudent just to have telerobots cover with at least a minimal amount of regolith first, just as the first thing you do after you roll out the inflatable habitat, you just cover it.
But, right. Well, I think, you know, space exploration, you talk about telerobots. I think space exploration is going to be done not by humans alone, not by robots alone, but by humans and robots together. You know, at Purdue, we're in a big agricultural area, and, you know, farmers don't till the fields by themselves. And if you ever get into a modern harvester, they're computer controlled, they're climate controlled inside, GPS guided. You know, a farmer can harvest a field of, you know, 60 or 100 acres with one of those things. It's humans and robots. You know, even now in the farming fields of the Midwest, and I don't think exploration of the moon is going to be any different.
Yeah, I agree with you. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Doug.
Okay, bye bye.
Your email comes from Bijan, who is over in Sweden, excuse me. Is there a distinction between craters caused by asteroids and comets, given that comets have another composition and often enter at much higher velocity and can be of arbitrary size up to Plutoids?
Well, to answer his question, I have to say I don't know. There's been a lot of speculation about that. We do not have a single crater on Earth that we can attribute to a comet. That doesn't say that none have been caused by comets, although we do think the cratering rate of asteroids is much higher than comets, simply because comets make one pass through the solar system and are gone, and asteroids make continual passes at the Earth. There probably are cometary impacts on the Earth. None have been recognized. One of the hardest things to tell about some given crater is what kind of object caused it. In only a few cases do we really know, and the reason is that the crater is typically 10 to 15 times larger in diameter than the object that made it, given that, you know, high impact velocities. And for a comet, the proportion is even higher because of their higher velocity. But if you think about that in terms of volume, to get the volume, you want to cube that. So there's, the volume of the Earth dirt moved by an impact is about 1,000 times larger than the volume of the projectile that made it. And so the material of the asteroid or comet is highly diluted in the material of the Earth. Now we can sometimes tell, melted rock, which is closer to the impactor, and asteroids and comets, we believe, are distinctive in having a few elements that are pretty rare in Earth's crust. Things like iridium, platinum, gold, palladium, things in the highly siderophile sequence. The Earth probably got a asteroidal type abundance of those things when it formed, but those particular elements have a high affinity for iron, and they sank to the Earth's core, leaving the crust very highly depleted. Not to say that iridium is abundant in asteroids. Its presence in an average asteroid is parts per billion, whereas abundance in the Earth's crust is parts per trillion. And so things like iridium are a good tracer for asteroidal impact. For a few craters, we can actually detect an increased abundance of those elements in the melt, and the ratio of those elements gives us some feeling for the nature of the impactor, whether it's a carbonaceous chondrite or an ordinary chondrite or what kind of meteor. Doing that versus comet, well, we think comets are probably about 50% rocky material. That's on the basis of the Deep Impact mission that I was part of, as well as the Rosetta mission to Comet 67P. It looks like most of the non-ice material is similar to carbonaceous chondrite, and so could we tell a cometary impact from a impact of a carbonaceous chondrite object? Maybe, if we knew the abundances well enough. But at least at the present time, it's not possible to say definitively that this particular crater on Earth, say, was made by a comet and not an asteroid. Sorry, long-winded answer, but it's a complicated question.
Well, if he wants more, he's listening by email, he can get a hold of us. Listeners, we're going to take a very short break because we're a little behind the eight ball on that, and we'll be back in about 1 to 2 minutes with our guests, so please don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Friday Space Show program. We want to thank our sponsor partners for the second segment of this program, the Integrated Space Plan, which is the highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. And if you go to the plan's website, thespaceplan.com, you can see how the various technologies and destinations build on one another and how the cells overlap. It's a useful tool. It's something that you will probably want a copy of, and you can order that copy at thespaceplan.com. It's also a great teaching tool for the youngsters in your household. The AIAA, American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, is a sponsor, and they are the largest professional aerospace organization around. They have more than 30,000 individual members. 88 countries are represented, roughly 100 corporate members, and they all work in the field, so they help shape the industry on a daily basis. Check it out at AIAA.org. Go to some of their events, Networking to Die For. You'll be really happy you got involved with the organization. And then Celestis is our partner. And they are still the only proven provider of Memorial Spaceflight Services in the world. And they're well known for launching a symbolic portion of an individual's cremated remains or possibly DNA, going to suborbital space, orbital space, lunar, and they hope soon deep space destinations. So if you're interested in doing a memorial for someone who loves space or someone who's very interested in it, or to maybe honor somebody, this is a great way to do that and have that particular type of closure. You can also add some of your DNA with your loved one's ashes or DNA, and you can symbolically join them on their mission, either suborbital, where you get the little tiny titanium canister back that was in suborbital space, or orbital, either from Vandenberg or from the Cape, lunar, and maybe someday going to Mars. Remember that lunar is supposed to go from New Zealand later this year or early next year with the new rocket by Rocket Labs. We'll see how that works. And also remember, I am their customer, so I really love the company. They're really great, but for transparency's sake, I am their customer. And I have another flight planned with my mom and two dogs on their lunar flight, so I sure hope it makes it. So our guest today is Dr. Jay Maloshin. Jay, you mentioned during the break new information which intrigued me on how our dinosaurs died. What can you say about this, and how do we get this new information?
Well, we have had a very successful program of drilling into the Chicxulub crater off the coast of Yucatan. The Chicxulub crater is the ground zero for the death of the dinosaurs. 66 million years ago, an asteroid about 12 kilometers in diameter touched down there, blasted out a hole in the ground about 170 kilometers across, and in the process, you know, led to the demise of basically every land animal on Earth with a mass of more than 15 kilograms. We think that anything that couldn't burrow at the time was probably killed off by either the thermal radiation pulse or the global forest fires that followed. We also were looking or interested in the structure itself. Inside the rim of the crater, there's a secondary ring of mountains that formed right after the collapse of the crater. We see so-called peak rings or inner rings in craters on the Moon, Mars, Mercury. And on those places, we don't understand very well how they form. We see the external form well enough, but we don't know much about the inside of them. On Earth, we have the opportunity to drill deeper, literally. We drilled about a kilometer and a half into the crater, brought back a core that contains broken and shocked rocks, as well as rocks from after the impact that document the both demise of the animals in the ocean near there, as well as the recovery of life afterwards. My particular interest was, you know, how the rocks are broken, smashed, and how they got there, how the crater collapsed, and how it flowed. And what we find there is strong evidence that, as in some very large landslides, right after the impact, the broken rock debris essentially turned into something like a liquid, not actually a liquid, it wasn't melted, but it flowed as if it were a very dense fluid. And we see the evidence for that right now in the core that was drilled into the crater.
So what does this mean for the dinosaurs? I mean, what happened to them? How long did it take for them to perish?
Well, it didn't. The structure of the collapse of the crater really was what happened afterwards. The dinosaur extinction was separate for that, and I apologize for perhaps conflating the two. What killed off the dinosaurs, we think, is actually the vaporized projectile and about an equal volume of target that expanded out of the crater afterwards. That was mainly the rock vapor that condensed into a whole bunch of little spherules, about the size of fine sand, maybe a fraction of a millimeter across, that were ejected like a fleet of little ballistic missiles that reentered our atmosphere afterwards, and in the process deposited a huge amount of energy in the upper atmosphere. That was the first indication that most parts of the Earth had that something bad was about to happen when this reentry into the upper atmosphere took place. Now, we're all familiar with meteors. See an occasional streak through the sky at night and maybe wish upon the star. But think of, not just one at a time, but, an entire sky full. And, in fact, so many that your line of sight only intersects other glowing bits of this sand-sized material, the amount of heat that is radiated onto the surface of the Earth is equivalent to what you'd get from a pizza oven, and that lasted, we think, for about an hour afterwards. And a lot of that is based on the what we find on the ground. We can see those sand-sized spherules, many places on the ground, buried now below the surface. And we know that they formed a layer of about 10 kilograms per square meter. That is an easy calculation to figure out the energy, which was enough to vaporize about a foot of water. And that energy arriving at, all at once was first enough to set all of the fires, all of the forests on Earth on fire. And secondly, any unprotected animals that couldn't get into a burrow, and that's most of the big dinosaurs, were basically roasted alive as a result of that. And that probably accounts for a good part of the land extinction.
Did that take very long? Was it over a period of weeks or months or almost instantly?
Well, not instantly, but probably over an hour.
Wow.
And so that was the first hour after the impact, and probably by the end of an hour after the impact, the entire Earth was a blazing ruin of forest fires with dead animals lying everywhere, except for the little critters like our ancestors and a few birds that made nests in the ground that could hide in their burrows for the time that the firestorm passed over.
That's pretty amazing that could happen that quickly around the entire Earth.
Well, if it didn't happen quickly, there probably wouldn't have been as profound an extinction. if you only sterilized half the Earth, say, you'd hardly have noticed it in a geologic record in terms of extinctions. There was a paleontologist named David Raup. Years ago, back in about 1980, when the impact was first recognized, who played what he called an extinction game. He had a database of the distribution of all animals on the Earth. He was associated with the Field Museum in Chicago, and he in his computer models, he would take the distribution of all the animals and say, okay, let me sterilize everything inside a circle of a given diameter on the Earth and call everybody inside it dead, and then how many species, how many families, how many of different class of organism died, and then compare that to the actual extinction. What he found is that his circle had to encompass essentially the entire Earth to have an extinction where, say, 50% of all families were extinguished. And what another way of saying it is, if you sterilized the entire Earth except for an area, say, the size of New Zealand, and then ask, how profound the extinction was, well, that was pretty much what we saw at the end of the Cretaceous. So it was a horrible day on Earth. Virtually every animal on Earth died that day, and probably within a few hours.
Well, too bad they didn't have a space program, right?
Exactly. If the dinosaurs had seen it coming, perhaps they could have done something about it, but they were just not smart enough.
Pretty amazing. Now, this crater is underwater. It's under the ocean, right?
It's underwater now and perhaps at the time of the impact. We don't really know for that, the details of that. More to the point, it's also under about a kilometer of other rock surrounding it. And I should correct that. About half of it is actually buried under the land of Yucatan. So if you're in, say, Merida, Yucatan, you're a bit, not quite in the center, but not too far from it. But it's buried under a kilometer of rock. And for that reason, it took about 10 years after we knew that there was an impact before it was actually recognized as the smoking gun.
So the fact that it was underwater, does that mean when the impact hit, it was underwater, and wouldn't the water have mitigated the damage somewhat?
Well, the water depth we estimate probably was on the order of 50 meters or so. And the asteroid was 12 kilometers. So from that point of view, the water was just a very thin veneer over the surface of the Earth.
And there is no doubt that this is the extinction crater.
There is no doubt for most of the scientific community. I'm a little bit hesitant to quite say that because some people may be aware of a recent story in Atlantic Monthly magazine in which a somewhat renegade scientist, Gerda Keller, argues that there was a volcanic eruption that was occurring in what is now India that was responsible for the extinction, not the impact. She is very much alone, and what she says very much disagrees with most of the data that we've acquired. But you can't say that there isn't a little bit of dissension, but I think the general scientific community accepts the fact that it was in fact the impact, and the data that we can acquire really strongly supports that.
Pretty amazing. You have another email that came in from our friend in Sweden. If a major iron asteroid like 16 Psyche hit the moon, would it leave rich iron, or what happens to the valuable asteroidal metals after an impact?
That's a great question. And from the point of view of colonization of the moon, I think people are probably much more interested, rather than iron — there's plenty of iron on the moon, it's combined with oxygen, but there's plenty there — but the big lack on the moon is water. And we'd love to find some area of which there was a lot of water. So more to the point, there are asteroids that are made of a lot of hydrated minerals that, if they were touched down on the moon and could be found, would in fact be a great resource for water. So it's a good question. A couple of years ago, a number of colleagues and I, doing numerical simulations of impacts, found that low-velocity impacts, or in a low-velocity impact of a moderate-sized asteroid a few kilometers across, that when these things touch down on the moon, they open the crater. The projectile at the low velocity doesn't vaporize, and you open a crater, it then collapses back in a way that we studied with the Chicxulub, the crater Chicxulub core, and brings that the asteroid itself back together again. You may do the experiment yourself. Take a little bit of milk and drop a drop of milk into, say, a cup of coffee, and you'll find that the drop opens a crater, and then as it collapses, it may form a little central jet, and in that jet, the milk is brought back together and forms a little blob. Now, in a cup of coffee, that gets mixed together pretty quickly, but for an impact crater, that central jet kind of freezes up, the fluidization departs, and it's left there. And so what we found is that there's a good chance that the impactor, if it's slow enough, could remain in the center of the crater. One of the things that we've been advocating is the idea that we have a kind of a lunar resource orbiter, mission we call LAROS, would actually look for the occurrence of hydrated minerals in the central peaks of some crater. If we could find a couple of cubic kilometers of, say, carbonaceous chondrite on the surface of the moon, maybe in a place a little less inaccessible than the lunar poles, I think that would be an area that there'd be a lot of interest in going to and exploiting that resource. A cubic kilometer of asteroidal material would have enough water to maintain a lunar civilization for probably hundreds of years.
Fascinating. Janet is in Denver, Colorado, and she says, I from time to time read articles where there is serious consideration being given to taking some dinosaur DNA that has been found and trying to recreate a living dinosaur. First of all, I don't know if this is really possible or not, or if they're just doing science fiction rhetoric for the fun of it. But were that possible, would you be supportive of bringing back a dinosaur species?
Well, I could say, yeah, I as a kid, I loved dinosaurs. Yes, I'd certainly love that. And a lot of people discuss that. Now, this is not my area of expertise, but my understanding is that, well, I know that DNA does degrade over time. That's something I have looked into from the point of view of how long microbes could survive a long space trip. And the dinosaur DNA, even though it's retrieved now, is still in tiny little pieces and fragments. And we don't have an entire genome. There's difficulty enough in people trying to put together mastodon genomes. You know, mastodons, you know, were frozen in the permafrost only a few thousand years ago, and still that DNA is broken up enough that it's pretty difficult to put back together. So there are enormous technical difficulties with that. Not to say that some clever people might figure out how to do that someday, but for right now, I think the general feeling is that that's not something that's technologically feasible. But I think it would be great if we could do it.
So if somebody could bring back a Tyrannosaurus rex, you'd be supportive of doing that?
Well, I'd start with some herbivores, I think, rather than big predators. If nothing else, from economic point of view, feeding a T-Rex might be pretty expensive, whereas herbivores could take care of themselves.
It would be interesting to, well, I mean, I guess you'd have Jurassic Park for real, except maybe with those that don't want to eat other animals. So it might be fun. I guess, I imagine that would happen. Are there any laws or ethical concerns that would stop that from happening today, or is it really an uncharted world?
Well, I can't speak as an expert. I would be surprised if there are real ethical concerns. Nobody claims them as ancestors. At least, although they are ancestors, I suppose, in a very distant way. I don't know. It may be some of the technology of putting that kind of DNA back together again could be used for nefarious purposes. That's way outside my field of expertise.
Well, teach them a space program, and then, you know, maybe they'd be contributors. Who knows? We are coming up on the end of the program, so what should we have asked you that we have failed to, or what else would you like to talk to us about today?
Well, in the break you were talking about lunar exploration, one of the things that I have been involved with is the analysis of the lunar gravity data that came back from GRAIL, and some of my graduate students and colleagues and I were able to use that gravity data to detect the existence of probable very large lava tubes underneath the lunar surface that might indeed form safe habitats for astronauts. As I mentioned earlier, the idea of inflatable shelters offers potential problems from radiation, of course, huge temperature swings on the surface of the moon, meteorite impacts, and if we could find open lava tubes, and we know that there are certainly some that would host astronauts, they would be safe underground shelters that we could initially at least form lunar colonies. If we're right about the size of the lava tubes we infer from gravity, we found some that are 80 kilometers long, several kilometers wide, and a few hundred meters high. You could put all of the city of Chicago probably in one of those lava tubes, and in a way that would be safe from most of the lunar hazards. It may be that the future of civilization on the moon is going back to the caves, like our earliest civilization.
What about your website you mentioned during the break?
Yeah, I in terms of the effects of impacts on the Earth, I did want to mention that if people are interested in exploring the effects of what an impact, say, on a city near them might be, they can go to a website at Purdue. We call Impact Earth! All run together in one word, Impact Earth, and there you'll find a website that we put together, some of my students and I, a few years ago, to actually answer the questions that we originally got from the media about what would happen if there was a meteorite impact close to us. You can put in information about the size, speed of the meteor, how far you are away from it, and it will then respond with telling you all of the effects that are caused by that at your location.
Okay, so it would be www.impactearth!.com, right?
That's right.
Okay. Our Swedish friend Bijan got in one final question for you, plus the fact he wants to thank you for your great answers to what he says you called his great question. But he says, could there be lumps of gold lying around on the moon today as there were on Earth before all the people picked them up?
I have to say I doubt it. And the reason is that ores on Earth, like lumps of gold, lumps of you know, virtually anything that's concentrated, are concentrated in hydrothermal circulations. Excuse me, where water, water heated by, on the Earth most of the time, volcanic eruptions, you know, dissolves some minerals and then deposits them in another location to make a concentrated ore. Impacts actually do that. Impacts leave hot bodies, and if there were water around, you might expect there to be ores. That might be a player on Mars, but on the moon there's no groundwater, and so I would not expect to find ores of that kind on the moon. The other thing that we were looking at with our GRAIL data, you know, one of the, you know, measuring gravity with high precision, you know, people measure gravity on the Earth, say in Canada, prospecting for extra dense minerals to find ores. That's something that the Canadian ore companies or mining companies do all the time. We didn't detect anything like that. We found a couple volcanic intrusions. We found some gravity deficits that correspond to the lava tubes. But there's nothing, no indications of, say, concentrations of extra dense or low density minerals. There are certainly gravity anomalies associated with impact craters. We think we understand those, but not any indication of ore type deposition.
Jay, this has been very informative. I'm glad we finally connected, and I appreciate it very much. I hope to be able to talk to you again on a future Space Show program, and want to, again, thank you very much for being with us today.
Okay, well, it's been fun. Thank you.
Okay, and listeners, Open Lines is on Sunday, so come back. And again, special thanks to Dr. Jay Maloche at Purdue University for being with us today. And everybody have a great weekend. It's just around the corner. keep looking up, and we will be back Sunday. Thanks again to Jay and to all of you who participated. Goodbye from the Space Show.